Hello there to my crown ones. This is Crown Riri and you're listening to the Crown Talk Podcast. On this podcast, I share my life experiences, my crown moments. That's when your heart and your crown aligns to motivate and inspire you to continue to wear your crown regardless how heavy it feels. Please visit crownones.com, crownones_com on Instagram and Crown Ones Facebook group for positive affirmation quotes and daily reminders by me that you are crowned. As always, don't forget your crown, and don't forget your crown. Enjoy the show. Hi, my name is Rebecca, aka Crown Riri, and this is Conversation Sunday. As my listeners know, I sit down and speak with an author, providing just a platform for them to share their published work and also share their story of what inspired them to write, their intentions on their published work, and we go from there. So I have Jason Masters here. Hi, how are you?
Well, good morning or good evening for you.
Oh, yeah, because evening here. What is it there?
It's about 10 o'clock in the morning here, a day in advance.
Yeah, and can you tell my listeners where you are?
So I live in a suburb just over the Harbour Bridge in Sydney, Australia, and I've been one of these people who I grew up in Adelaide, the capital of South Australia, and after university I went to Melbourne, the capital of Victoria, and now I'm in Sydney, which is not the capital of Australia, it's the capital of New South Wales.
Awesome. A lot of travelling.
Yes.
I just got my birth certificate and I'm trying to get my passport. I'm like, now I can travel. Like, I feel like I have like a gateway to go everywhere. So,
yeah, excellent.
You might see me in Australia.
As Australians, we're practically born with our passport. We're kind of the Southern Hemisphere version of the Swedish who just travel. And we travel a lot overseas. So,
awesome. Well, I might make a stop.
Yes.
We shall see.
Well, it's probably the end stop, because you can't go much further south in this part of the world.
Oh, right. Yeah, you are correct. Awesome. So can you tell us who you are and the reason why you're here today as far as like what you're... I don't like to use the word book. I like to say published work. Yes. I feel like book is like so general. So yeah, introduce yourself and tell us like about your published work.
So my name is Jason Masters. The book is called A Journey Towards Acceptance, an Evolving Memoir. So, you know, I'm a lot of different things, and that was one of the interesting things last night. We actually had the official book launch last night, and bringing together people from my church community, bringing people together from my business community, family members, and then people from the LGBTIQ plus community all came together for the book launch last night, which was just an amazing night. Mm. So I was married for 20 years to a woman before I finally had to come to accept who I am as a gay man and come out. I've got two wonderful young adult children, one who's doing her doctors of physiotherapy at university. The other has just finished his engineering honours and arts degree and is just wrapping that up to start his professional life. And he just decided to get married or propose to his fiancée the other weekend. So that's all very exciting. So there's the family. Awesome. I've had a long involvement with the Uniting Church in Australia, which is a local denomination. It's the third largest in Australia, which came about in 1977 from the merger of the Methodist Church, the Congregational mm-hmm. Church, and about 75% of the Presbyterian Church. So that's where my faith is. And then having come out, I do a lot of advocacy in the LGBTIQ space. So, you know, why the book, which is really an interesting question. Last night at the launch, we had a gentleman called Anthony Ben Brown, who wrote a similar book. He was a pastor, very significant pastor in the Evangelical Church here in Australia. He was married had children and came out late in life. And that book was written and published in 2004. This is only the second book of this genre, you know.
Oh, wow.
A senior religious person, business person, married, coming out. And, you know, there are a lot of men who do get caught up in opposite orientation marriages because mm-hmm. often driven by faith. And what was interesting is not long after I came out, I was attending a support group called Freedom to Be. Unfortunately, it's not around anymore, but it was an organisation set up for LGBTIQ Christians to meet.
Wow.
And so I went to that for a year, kind of its last year before it folded. And so we met actually in the Akon Health, which is the LGBTIQ health organisation that came out of the HIV support crisis in the 1980s. And then we'd go out for dinner at one of the local pubs. And a couple of people said, oh, you've got to write your story. And there were, you know, a number of formerly married gay men in this group, and there were women and trans people as well. And I thought that was a bit odd. You know, I've only just come out, I've only just joined this group. Why do you think my story is so different?
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept getting this message from people, you know, your story is important, please share it. And so my original intent was to, you know, just write something, put it in a PDF and put it up on one of my websites. And then I got invited to the Asia Pacific Rainbow Families Forum, which was being held in Hong Kong. And mm-hmm. I thought to be on a panel of the intersectionality of faith and work and being part of the LGBTIQ plus community. And I thought, actually, that might be a good place just to try telling my story, because I hadn't actually publicly told my story. So first time telling your story in another country is just kind of a safe place to do it.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, they had a number of sponsors, one of which was actually one of the international high schools in Hong Kong. They had actually raised a lot of money to bring some international speakers, particularly from a country where being an out gay is illegal. And so one of the things we had to do at this conference is when people from those countries were speaking, we had to completely shut down all our mobile phones. We couldn't tweet. We couldn't do anything. So their identities weren't exposed that they're at this event.
I love that.
Yeah. It was great. And it was also very important for us to hear what it's like in those countries. So I was speaking on this panel. I was speaking with a wonderful transgender lady who's a Christian, a Muslim man from Fiji who's now just moved to a senior executive position at a hotel chain in London, mm-hmm. and then myself. So I told my story, and I had a throwaway line that I was thinking of writing. And the teacher who was bringing along this group of kids from this international school in Hong Kong came up to me and said, "You've got to write your story, and it can't be just doing a PDF on a website." And she had just written a book, Fooled Twice, I think it's called, Jules Hannesford, about, you know, she's an ally. She'd been trying to find a partner, and she got caught up twice in these internet scams. And
oh, wow.
So she knew Pashmina P as her mentor and highly recommended me go talk to her. So I did, and then starts a long journey of actually putting together this published work.
Awesome. And the title is A Journey Towards Acceptance in Evolving Memoir. And I love the word evolving because we're never completely in ourselves. I want to say, like, we're constantly evolving. And we were talking before we recorded, and I was saying how, like, I go outside and just marvel, like, at the leaves falling, which is something I haven't done since I was, like, a young child. But what inspired you to put that word evolving in the title of your
publication? It's an interesting question. I love the way you picked up on that. And I think there is two elements to it. The one you've picked up on, that we are constantly evolving, and I'm still evolving as a person. So this is a book at a point of time. It doesn't include everything. There are parts that I've intentionally excluded. I may want to revisit those later on. But we also thought, you know, I'm young enough that there, you know, hopefully there's still many years in my life that I could then write a sequel. What has actually transpired, and once we get through this launch process, I'll actually start writing the sequel. Mm-hmm. I had been to an LGBTIQ conference in Florida over the summer of 2019-20, Northern Hemisphere winter in Florida. It was the Gay Christian Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually starting to build up to market the book. You know, it was getting close to be finished and I wanted to do some research around it. I was actually a chaplain at the conference, so you know, it was a really good place to be. Coming home, you know, people might remember the awful bushfires we were having in Australia that summer.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of stuff going on about that. And then I was starting to hear about this virus coming out of China. And I was actually working on an international project when the original SARS came out and mm-hmm. was actually had to go into China at the very last days of SARS. I was actually there when it was declared free of SARS. So it was a scary time. So I could see this thing coming and was worried about it. And so in February, I actually moved our business out of the office in the city, got people back into homes, started working from home.
Awesome.
And in fact, the last day I was in the office was when the Ruby Princess cruise liner came into Sydney, which unloaded hundreds of people with COVID. A number of people had died, in fact, people from outside Australia. Mm. And then we had our official lockdown started on the 23rd of March. And one of the things they were saying in the lockdown is you're allowed out of your home in your immediate area for 1 hour a day for exercise. And so it was really good. And it was, you know, good for mental health and good for physical health. And so on that day, I thought, I bought this place because there are a lot of trails around. It's sort of semi-bushline urban around here. So I went on a new trail and went through the wasn't very difficult part. And then I was going behind some homes, getting back up to the street. And we just had a very bad summer storm and a big gum tree had fallen over the pathway.
Yeah.
Around it. So I stepped up onto it and clipped my back foot. And I'm a tall guy. I'm, 189 centimetres, 6'2 and a half. And so then, on another foot plus inch, a trunk fell and landed on my shoulder. And then embarked a whole story of seven operations on my shoulder. I've now got a disability in it and was basically locked down for 22 months for all the healthcare I needed to go through.
Goodness.
I think the next book is going to be around we're still working on the title at the moment, but it might mm-hmm. be, one step up, falling down and living through COVID. And so the journey of being a gay man, having, so many operations, so many procedures that I ended up, ICU from one of them, being isolated for such a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
People complained about being isolated for 2 or 3 months. Being in situations where I was in a rehabilitation hospital for 6 months as an outpatient and with occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy and social worker cares around, And even I, as a patient, couldn't go into the hospital on some occasions. So actually having to do physiotherapy over this sort of Zoom and things like that. Created a whole lot of mental health issues, physical issues, family complexities. One time there it was very difficult with when my son was doing his honours. So mm-hmm. I think that's going to be, probably a 4-year story of window into surviving COVID.
Yeah, and that's a part of evolving is, going through that, narrating your story
And then, like we were saying before, like speaking about coming out into the world and still trying to hold on to our safe place. So yeah, I'm learning that myself. I have to remember that, well, my therapist told me that what's healthy may, what's comfortable may not be healthy for you. And I have to like remember that every day, because I could stay home for like 2 weeks, you know, order my groceries and do things, but I have to remind myself, I have to like go outside and I have to do these people, social things, because it's good for your health, even though as introverts, it's scary. But when you're there, it's like, oh, okay, it's not that bad. And you can always, I always say, find my corner and be like,
That's
I'm
right.
standing over here away from everybody else, but I'm here.
Exactly.
And you being, you know, 22 months, I can just imagine the restarting of everything.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things I'm spending, you know, a bit of time with my psychology therapist around the importance of going out, you know, not getting stressed. And I'm on a couple of boards and audit committees that aren't in Sydney, and they were things that I did do last year. And you know, I've traveled a lot. I'm a top tier flyer with Virgin Australia, one of our domestic airlines, which has partners all around the world. And so it's kind of scary every year when you get, you know, you're in the top 10 or 5% of their flyers. And so then not flying for quite a while and then starting to fly. And I'm one of these people. I remember when I started a job as the chief audit executive for Fujitsu Australia, which covered all their subsidiaries in the South Pacific from PNG to BG, and also subsidiaries in India, or some subsidiaries in India. And I joined, and we had an issue in New Zealand, and I was having to go over there every fortnight. And the first time I called the travel desk and said, right, I need to go. When can I go on this flight, please? And it's a 767. And whilst it's being sold as a Qantas flight, it's a New Zealand aircraft, so I want this seat, please. And she said, oh, you travel a lot, so we can't muck around with you, can we? And I said, yeah. I know pretty much every aircraft type that flies in and out of Australia, and I know what seat I want. And
oh, wow.
So that's how much trouble. And so I had it down pat, you know, for each airline that I was flying internationally, how long I had to be at the airport before, what their queues were like. And I used to have a hire car driver who used to pick me up to get me home. And if he was busy, he would always hand it off to one of his colleagues. And he always had to tell them, Jason will be, have nothing checked in. He'll be through immigration, picking up his bag and out of custom in 15 minutes. So don't get there 30 minutes late, you know, expecting him to wait forever.
Right.
And so I just knew how to travel. So when I started to travel, it was very hard for me, because I now have this disability. I've now got, you know, titanium in this arm. So, you know, I basically set off the machines most of the times I go through it. So I can prepare for that. One airline, Rex and Virgin Australia, who fly out of one terminal, actually give people with disabilities a quick path to go through, where Qantas, our international airline, refuses to. They don't give people with disability any additional help unless you're, you know, seriously disabled, which is, I'm disappointed with the approach Qantas takes.
Right.
But you know, how long were these queues going to be? Because one of the things the airports have had trouble with in Australia is getting people for security checkpoints. And so what used to be never more than 20 minutes to get through security,
right,
is over 2.5 hours.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
And so everything I knew that was very natural for me had been done. So now I've done it enough times, I'm starting to build up the pattern again, and it's starting to work.
Yeah, like I was saying earlier, like our minds and our bodies, sometimes we just adopt without even knowing it, and we're back on track, and we're just preparing ourselves for, you know, what could happen. So that's awesome. Yeah, so my word, I'm going to take the evolving and add that to my word bank for 2023.
That's good. That's good.
Awesome.
And then there's another interesting thing, which is actually the last line in the book, which I used to coach high school basketball here in Sydney. And well, it wasn't in a high school. It was a group of high school kids who wanted to play in the local domestic comp. And one of the things that, you know, teenagers often struggle with is when they make a mistake, they, you know, they can be quite hard on themselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for people who know basketball, you know, we've got five people on each team on the court. If somebody's putting a shot up that they think they should have got and they miss, they can kind of get down on themselves. The other team gets the ball, sprints down, and so you've only got four players defending. So I coined this word, this little saying for them. I can't change the past, but I can influence the future. And so that was a saying I developed. And it was interesting, some years down that pathway, I was asked, encouraged to go on a spiritual retreat. And one of the things that they do there that you don't know about is that your sponsor contacts all the people you know and asks them to write a letter. And one of the lads in this basketball team was the son of my minister at the time. So they knew all the parents in the basketball team. So I got some lovely letters. And a number of the parents said, yeah, that was not only helpful for them on the basketball court, but also helpful for the parents when they're helping their kids get through their teenage years. And then what I've discovered as I've journeyed through coming out late in life is I've been doing all this what if, you know, what if I had come out when I was this, you know, what if I did this, what if I did that, what if somebody else did it? And, you know, working through this with my therapist, you know, my term I coined for the kids on the basketball court has become a term for me. I actually can't change the past. There's been so much that's wonderful in the past.
Right.
You know, obviously some things that have been pretty ugly, but now it's about letting that go and trying to influence the future.
Yes, that's very true. Because now, like, you are a new evolving person in this future. Is that one of the things that you want your readers to take away, is that, you know, this, to me, it is brave of you to come out, especially, you know, with the process of what your life was going through. You know, somebody may feel like, okay, well, this is normal, but they don't feel normal. Do you think, or do you feel like that part of your published work, that's going to be like a takeaway for people to like be honest with themselves before anybody else?
I think so. And I think there's some generational issues. So for me, when I was working through being honest with myself about being gay, I was you know, looking at a lot of stuff on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of wonderful coming out stories, but they're mainly of the younger generation. One of the things they often talk about is that, you know, a huge weight has been lifted off their shoulders and they can be who they are. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of young people who come from conservative families that they get more oppressed than lifted up. But for most of the kids in Australia, where, say, compared to America, religion here is important, but not dominating, although there are some rear guard actions to try and do that. But in my case, after coming out, I actually entered into some of the worst of my suicidal periods. And so I think part of, and a number of people have said to me that it's a very raw work. And I was talking to somebody recently and I said, I'm interested in your comment, why that? And he said, well, it's not a criticism. It's actually an endorsement, because it has to be raw to honestly explain your story. And so that was a really interesting perspective. So there are still a lot of people who are married in opposite orientation marriages who are LGBTIQ. And I think one of the important messages for me from this book is coming out is can be really good, but there is still some difficulty in that journey. But you can get through that. And yeah, there is goodness and light and love and all the rest of it through that and at the end.
Yeah, I never understand anybody's obsession about who somebody else's love. I always say, like, we're loving strangers. Like, honestly, like, when you meet somebody and you fall in love with them, you don't know who they are. Like, you don't, you know, but then it's like, it shouldn't be my business if, like, my neighbor next door loves somebody that, like, I don't even, like, they don't know, like, they're strangers. Like this obsession to, like, just be, like, in somebody else's relationship has nothing to do with me. It's like, mind-boggling to me.
Exactly.
I'm like, why? We care, like, it's not you, but, you know, we should be more embraceful if anything. But
yeah, and a lot of this rejection of the LGBTIQ plus community is driven from a faith perspective, and there's been a documentary just been released in America, played at the New York documentary film festival. I think it's just been at the Palm Beach in California. And it's getting absolute rave reviews. I've met the director of it. She's the daughter of a Christian minister who's a lesbian. And I think there is a quick photograph of me in the credits. So she's talking a bit about her story as a lesbian in a religious household and that. And then another good friend of mine called Kathy Baldock, who lives in Nevada, she wrote an absolutely amazing piece of work, really from a perspective of an ally. So she was from a very conservative church, and her husband left her, which is just, you know, devastating in that community.
Yeah.
And so she had to rebuild herself, and what she kept stumbling across as she was rebuilding herself, you know, getting out and meeting people, developing your social network.
Mm-hmm.
She was being connected with all of these LGBTIQ people. And she said to God, you know, why am I being connected with these people? And then her seminal piece of work, Canyon Walkers, brings together this concept of all the falsehood that's gone into particularly the Christian narrative. And then she wanted to go and research or find out why the word homosexual was never in the Bible before 1946. And she stumbled across that the archives of all of that work was stored at Yale University.
Oh, so wow. She
got access to that university material and researched it and found that there was a young Canadian minister who just came out of seminary, who was one of the few people to write to the translators saying, you've actually translated this word wrong, and it's going to be turned into a sacred weapon against the LGBTIQ community.
And
they acknowledged that they probably had made a mistake, but the contract they had with the publishers, they couldn't change anything for 10 years. And in that 10 years, that translation became the sacred weapon that was being used to attack the LGBTIQ community.
Oh, wow.
And then when you look at years later when the NIV Bible came out, now that was translated at, I think, Wharton University, a conservative Christian university. Now, she had an associate working, doing the research, who was a man. So they actually had to switch roles to get into Wharton because a woman wouldn't be allowed to be the lead researcher in that environment. They got access there. And one of the things the NIV translators were saying, well, this was a robust new, you know, translation in the 1970s. But they didn't do the work around these sections. They just copied the Revised Standard Version. And so that then became another anchor for what has become, I suppose, the preferred Bible of the conservative evangelical movement.
Right.
So this director and this book, they came together and they've told this amazingly powerful story. In New York, they won the attendees award, and they've got a lot of accolades out of the film showing in California. So a lot of what's happening in faith communities is based on a whole lot of your false premises.
And,
at worst, you can say there are six verses in the Bible that can be used to condemn, and all of those can be broken down as being not relevant, related to mistranslation, related to wrong context, all of that sort of stuff. How many times is the word love mentioned in the Bible?
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my words for 2023 as well. Yeah, I'm learning how to, speaking of love, but I'm learning how to create my own definition of love. That way I'll know when it's actually presented to me and when it's not. So yeah, and that's like, you know, like you said, that's the gist of it, with dealing with strangers and who you love, your definition of it. So.
And I think that's the other key part of the title of this published work is, you know, A Journey Towards Acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't accept who I was or am. And so you develop all of these behaviors to manage that. And it's actually not healthy. You know, I traveled for work a lot. I did a lot of work in my church. I did, you know, a lot here. So my tool set was to do a lot, and I was actually involved in on the board of the National Christian Youth Convention here in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably after that when I first had my first mental breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually part of the overwhelming part of it was there were two different educational content around sexuality. One was around a skit around two young sort of teenagers in a mm-hmm. youth group who had sex and then were ostracized by that their social group. And the other one was about a teaching from a young gay minister who just come out of Bible college.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people reacted very differently, and you know, a lot of the international delegates, which was one of the areas I had responsibility for, threatened to walk out of the conference. So I had this major hillside meeting with people from Papua New Guinea and Fiji and Indonesia and places around, trying to get them to stay, and they all stayed.
Mm-hmm.
But what we realised out of that was there was a lot of people, and it was particularly the leaders who were bringing these younger people to this convention.
Yeah,
actually hadn't dealt with their own sexuality or their own theology towards sex, even if they were heterosexual.
Yeah.
But the young people wanted this conversation, and so the leaders were very, very upset. So a long story for a short thing, after that, I actually stopped. My minister said, you're exhausted, Jason, have a break. And, you know, we'll find people to do your roles, but just take 3 or 4 weeks out. And as those weeks went on, I was starting to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And that led me into my first process of therapy, which went for 3 years. Mm. And it was, but I kept ignoring my issues of sexuality. And
like you were creating distractions so you wouldn't have to deal with the actual thing, the actual confrontation in front of you, which is ourselves. But like you said, when that silence, it is a show called Frasier that I love. And he has like this breakdown, but he's like in his living room and he cries and he can't stop crying. And his dad's like, what's wrong with him? Like, why can't he stop crying? And he was like, I don't know. He's a psychologist, which is the part that I love. But he's like, I can't stop crying because like he never had that moment of just sitting still. Until that happened. And they're like, are you broke? He's like, I don't know. I'm just crying. So I always think about that when like I don't want to like deal with stuff. I'm like, okay, it's gonna be a moment where I'm just gonna sit down and like cry. I don't know what's going on and have that moment. Do you think it's like one of those moments for you?
Yeah, so I wrote a poem. So in Australia we have a thing called Anzac Day, which the closest thing you have in America is Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
But all the people who have come to Australia and seen our Anzac Day said, I wish we could have that for our Memorial Day. It's not a day of celebration here.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a day where we lost a battle on the beaches in Gallipoli against the Turkish. And my grandfather was actually in the second wave there, and he got ill and had to be evacuated. My father was on HMAS Australia, which was the battleship of the Australian fleet, and the first ship ever hit by kamikazes in World War II towards the end of the war. And my dad had only joined the war as a 17, 18-year-old at the end of the war. And they actually wouldn't bring the ship back to Australia to get it fixed because they were fearful that all of the seamen would, you know, run away. And so they took it to, I think it was Port Vila, where the Americans had a base, got it refitted, and then it was attached to the American Fifth Fleet for the liberation of the Philippines, where it got hit by five kamikazes in 3 days, and that's where my dad was injured.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, because of that, you know, we didn't know what PTSD was, post-traumatic stress disorder was. You know, I remember as about a 14-year-old when my dad was in the Veterans Hospital at one stage, and the specialist came and said to Mum and I, you know, we need to have a chat. And so we went into his room, and he basically said, I can see what's happening in your household. The two of you are walking around on eggshells around your husband and father. If you keep doing that, you're going to die before he does.
Oh, wow.
And so that's a pretty hard thing to deal with as a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my dad and I had a very complex relationship. And and he had a love-hate relationship with Anzac Day. It was one of the few days that I saw him drunk, and he often wouldn't go because I think it brought back memories. In fact, only once did he ever tell me anything about what he experienced, and it was 30 minutes after we watched The Battle of Midway as a movie. So I never really heard firsthand very much of what happened. So I wrote this poem. The therapist I was seeing at the time, was a 30-year veteran. You know, he kept saying to me, I was one of the worst cases of emotional abuse he'd ever seen in his life. Mm. And I wrote this poem about Anzac Day, and he started to cry.
Oh, wow.
And he said, I'm in a real dilemma with your poem because I hate what you're saying about Anzac Day, but it's giving me a mirror of what it's like to be one of the firstborn of a Second World War veteran. One of the youngest firstborn of a World War II veteran. And he said, that's bringing up so much conflict between how I view Anzac Day and then how I see that. So that was kind of the first one. I think the seminal one for me was, as part of that body of work, I went on a program for about 12 weeks, which culminated in a weekend. And this group of people, you know, we would do therapy in front of each other. We would, you know, learn meditation, which I still struggle with doing, and things like this, all the different tools we could use. And I kept seeing people go up doing therapy in front of the class, you know, a girl who'd been raped by her father and uncle, man who was raped by his sister and his father, a man who was just had the crap beaten out of him as by his father. And all that did to me, kept saying, that's what abuse is. What I've suffered, what people are calling emotional abuse, doesn't really exist. So anyway, towards the end of the last day, my name came out of the hat, and I did some therapy in front of the group. And what was interesting is afterwards that those group of three people came up to me and said, individually, but all as a group, but each had a version of this saying, none of us want to be abused in our families, but watching you on that stage going through therapy and what you dealt with in emotional abuse, we're so much happier, but we're pleased we had physical stuff that people can relate to. Emotional abuse people can't relate to, and all that goes into these layers of emotional abuse. So that if I would say is the seminal moment that helped my mental health trajectory was the breakthrough of understanding that emotional abuse is a real thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we don't, like, physical abuse, like, we see it.
Yeah.
Mental abuse, we're just not accepting that that's, like, an actual thing. Emotional abuse is, like you said, someone has to tell you, or you have to tell that person, and they have to accept that they are the ones that's doing the emotional abuse. That's a whole
thing. And it was interesting for me, just before COVID, I was asked to be a speaker at a business event. This IT company brings together a lot of their clients and their guests. And they have a theme about a service they sell. And I think their approach is just beautiful in that they really don't sell their services the night. They might speak about it for 2 or 3 minutes, but the guest speaker gives the insight. And the theme was change. And they often have also an artist there. So there was a gay artist who had a lot of work up on the wall, actually bought a piece. And so I was talking about the changes that have gone through my life.
Right.
And at the end, you know, it was questions and answers. And one of the senior business people got up and said, look, I don't know if this is an appropriate question to ask, Jason. I said, look, my approach is there's no inappropriate question apart from abuse.
Right.
I may choose not to answer it. He said, fair enough. So he said, you talked about emotional abuse. I've never heard of it. And so we're talking, 2019, senior business person, not even here understanding that emotional abuse is one of the key abuses. And now we're seeing it, particularly in domestic violence with women, one of the abuses that is being well and truly understood now is that emotional abuse, particularly around controlling finances and things like that.
It's so amazing how, like, we learn, like, we're finally putting names to things that we know or we feel, but we're putting a name to it. So important. So how do you practice continual self-love?
So that still remains one of my biggest challenges. at the book launch last night, I did it slightly differently. Rather than doing readings or something like that, I had a leading advocate here in Sydney sort of be the host. And then I had three people being interviewed by him. The first one was a friend of mine. You know, how did you get to know Jason? You know, what was he like back in 1991, and how did your friendship evolve?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever perceive he might be gay? When you found out, you know, how did you react to that? And then, what advice might you have for people? And then the second guest speaker was the author of the only other book of this particular genre in Australia. And the third one was my son, giving a child's perspective. What was interesting with Hugh Murphy, who was the first speaker, my friend, was even before I came out, he was always worried that I was doing too much.
Mm.
And then when I came out, I kind of ramped up the amount of work I did. And that's got to do with, you know, elements of shame and things like that.
Yeah.
And he said last night, the thing, you know, I'm going to be working on you with you, Jason, is, you know, pulling back, because I don't need to do everything now to prove who I am.
Right.
That's a big change for me. And so one of the things I took a risk was we're heading up to World Pride, first time in the Southern Hemisphere, being held in Sydney, starts in a few weeks' time. A massive festival, but there's a lot of pre-Pride activities happening. And there was a piece of theatre, the first time it's been run in the theatre in Australia by a local playwright. And so I thought, I know I'm going to get stressed out in the lead up to my book launch. I'm going to book myself to go see that show on Friday night. And I have to go. And no matter what's happening, I have to go. And that's how I'm trying to deal with it at the moment. So now we're through the book launch, I'm now going to start to book into, you know, see things at the Queer Film Festival. I do have a spot in the Mardi Gras Parade. I do have a spot in the walk over the Harbour Bridge at the end of the closing of World Pride. So I think it's now finding those things that I enjoy. And one of the things that I've started to realise is that I actually don't have a hobby.
Oh.
I've always been doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually don't have a hobby. And maybe some of my advocacy work fits into a part of a hobby, but it's also very exhausting work.
That's not a hobby.
Yeah, I don't think it's a hobby.
No, so, it's not.
So one of the things I've got to do now is find a hobby. And I used to umpire basketball a lot and was involved. And through my injury, I haven't been doing that for the last year or so. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually going to go try and meet up with the Basketball Association and say, look, what can I do that gets me and become a bit of my hobby and things like that?
I'm going to send an email. I've taken up Lego.
You know, as that person in the mid-40s has taken up, you know, Lego, and apparently there's a whole adult culture around Lego building.
Yeah. Oh, I just fell in love with puzzles, and I'm 37, so it's no problem. Yeah. So I'm going to send an email out to you one day to check and see have you got a hobby yet.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, hobbies are important. I have a hobby. I'm actually in my hobby room.
Yes.
But it's good on the mental health. I love to crochet. I've been crocheting since I was 10. And when I just need like a moment away, I'll pick up yarn and needle and just crochet. And
yeah.
Yeah. For that 30 or 45 minutes, like my mind is just focused on that and everything else is quiet. So, yes, I will send you an email. I'm like, I'm just checking.
And my memory is one of the things I'm struggling with a little bit after my accident is my short-term memory. The British diver who won gold medals in the Olympics, a gay man, he knits and he's famous for his knitting and crocheting. And you often see him beside a pool knitting and crocheting.
I think I've seen that picture before, but I can't remember his name. But yeah. It's very good on the mental. It really is.
Yes. Yeah.
Because your mind is like, wow, look at this. So
that's right.
And our last question. So I created a word called Crown Woman. And that's when your heart and your crown aligns. And that could be a moment where you're just sitting in silence and you have that aha moment. Or it could be like a life lesson. Can you share a crown moment with us?
I think my crown moment is you can't change the past, but you can influence the future.
Mm.
And I think seeing that as something to help teenagers being adapted for myself as an adult and saying, yeah, this is actually really important for you as an adult was my crown moment.
I love that. And let me just add on, how can we create a safe place for the LGBTQI community? How can we create a safe space?
So there's lots of different ways. There's a lot of controversy around email signature blocks where people put he, him, they, them, she, her in.
Mm-hmm.
I would really encourage allies to do that because that lets people know that you're a safe person. Other things like last night at my book launch, and interestingly enough, nobody took it up, which is I think shows the quality of my friends and my business associates, but we had big name tags. And a lot of LGBTIQ events, people don't want to be photographed. Like that queer Christian conference I mentioned, I went to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
They get well over 1,000 people. They have two coloured lanyards, and I'm going to get it the wrong way around. But a blue one essentially means you're happy to be photographed. And a red one means you're not willing to be photographed. Because often you'll find ministers come to that event who realise their theology around LGBTQ LGBTQ plus people isn't sustainable. Mm-hmm. But they've got a very conservative congregation. So they're on a learning journey, and this is a really important conference for them on that learning journey. But nobody could know they're there.
Mm.
So I gave people an opportunity. Everybody had a white name, big name tag to stick on, and then there was a tan circle that they could just put there to let people know. And we had photographers and videographers there last night, and people were taking their own snaps to say, you know, I don't want to be photographed. And if you do happen to photograph me and it's a great photograph, make sure you cover out my face and my name and any other identifying marks. So that's a really important thing to do if you're running, you know, particularly if you're an executive in a company and you're wanting to run an event or starting to be more LGBTQ plus inclusive and you're running your first event. If you can let people know that there is a safe way to get in there without being seen, a safe way to be there and not be photographed.
Mm.
It's a really important thing for people to discover how safe an organization you actually are.
I love that because it's a small act, but it means so much. And when we ask, like, what can we do to support, you know, we always think like this mega big thing. And then it's like, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. But it's like the smallest thing can be like such like a safe. I love that. Like, because number one, me and social media do not get along. it's a love and hate relationship myself. And, you know, like you said, like some people are learning how to come out. Some people need that safe place. And just to have that permission of saying, you know, I don't want to be photographed and have somebody respect that. It's just amazing to me.
And if everybody can just do one or two of those small things, rather than trying to do the big thing, that's where the real change happens. Because what we know is change is a series of footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why in my book title, there's the footsteps. Now, that has a number of connotations. There's that saying of Jesus, where were you when I was in my most difficult period? While I was carrying you. So that's one connotation.
Mm-hmm.
Another connotation is how do we just take one step at a time to move forward?
And, love it.
And so when we're trying to be, you know, affirming and inclusive in our workspace, in our community groups, whatever, if we can just take those one little steps, we'll actually lead to some of the bigger changes.
Right. Oh, I love that. Hmm. It's like my mind thinking, like, how can I apply that to, you know, like my community and everything? Oh, yes. Okay.
I'll send you an email now saying, yeah, how are you going?
Thank you. Because, yeah, it's just that I'm learning so much from you and just taking away so much. That's why when you hear me say, or yeah, it's like, yeah, crown moment. I'm grasping on to what you're telling me. So I know that Journeys Towards Acceptance and Evolving Memoir is going to inspire so many people because this conversation has inspired me. And thank you for having this conversation with me. Is there anything else that you want the Crown listeners to take away from the book or from, you know, you yourself?
I think at the end of the day, all of us go through difficult periods. And if we've got the right support structure around us, we can get through it. Now, the LGBTIQ community has the highest suicide rates in the world. And a lot of that comes from the religious groups and rejection of family, things like that. So, you know, getting the right people around you. I had a really good group of friends. My psychologist was, after my first post coming out, suicidality. I got to see him very urgently. He was very supportive and, you know, he wouldn't let me leave until I had a whole lot of numbers in. And then as I went through the consequences of my accident, I had to add a psychiatrist into my health network. Mm. And he wanted another number put in my telephone on my phone. So getting all of that support. As a businessman, one of the things I liked about my psychologist, he was trying to find language that I could relate to. And and I said, you know, these really big events really hard. And he said, Jason, think about your journey like the stock market. You know, the stock market has generally gone on an upward trajectory.
Yeah.
But on a weekly or daily and weekly basis, there are these little ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and again, there's a big stock market crash, but it recovers. And then it starts to go up again.
Yeah.
And so in the depth of that big crash, that's where your support network can help you do the rapid improvement to then start the journey onwards and upwards. So I was trying to find analogies that really help you hold on to the challenges in those difficult times.
Yes. And like you said, we ourselves, the readers, the listeners out there, you know, we have to create that safe space, not only for us, but for the community. Because like I said, I love love, and I feel like, you know, strangers love strangers, and I'm rooting for that.
Whilst in the book, I've intentionally not gone through a lot of the background of emotional abuse. It was not something I wanted the purpose of the book to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot of mental health issues. So, again, it was doing little things. Last night at the book launch, there was a very dear friend of mine who's a minister in my denomination, who's a school chaplain. That's where she has her placements. Mm-hmm. And so I just said to her, would you mind just if somebody has any problems, because of the conversation we might have, that we could just say you're here? And a number of people commented, you know, yeah, there were some oh my God moments in my being interviewed last night. But they came up to me and said, I just hadn't thought of, you know, you're thinking of saying, well, there's a chaplain here to support you if this gets too much.
Mm.
My host, you know, told everybody the numbers for QLife, which is the LGBTIQ+ emergency lifeline, and also Lifeline, which is our major mental health crisis number. So, again, these little things, just help people prepare. Oh, okay, there might be some tough parts in this conversation.
But
Jason and his team have already thought about that. And so we're going to get through it.
I love that. And they're little things, but they mean so much to people, for them to be seen and heard. And I mean, we're all trying to be heard and seen, but the safe place is where where we should be in that order.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you again for joining me. If you can stay on the line while I close up the show, I would appreciate it. Again, to my crowns out there, you've heard Jason Masters, A Journey Towards Acceptance, an Evolving Memoir. And it's on, it's out now, correct?
It's out now. It's on Amazon, both as Kindle and paperback in most of the regions around the world.
Awesome. So my crowns.com website will have the link to purchase a copy of the book. I'm going to purchase my copies, because I love to support the authors. And again, this conversation itself is so inspiring. So I know that I'm going to be, I have Jason's email, so I'm famous. Tell him how much I appreciate him creating this safe space by telling his story. To my crowns out there, please visit crowns.com. Again, this is Crown Riri. This has been Conversation Sunday. Don't forget you are crowned, and don't forget your crown. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello out there to my crown ones. This is Crown Riri, and you're listening to the Crown Talk Podcast. On this podcast, I share my life experiences, my crown moments. That's when your heart and your crown aligns, to motivate and inspire you to continue to wear your crown, regardless how heavy it feels. Please visit crownones.com, crownones_com on Instagram, and Crownones Facebook group for positive affirmation quotes and daily reminders by me that you are crowned. As always, don't forget your crown, and don't forget your crown. Enjoy the show.